In 1989, I took a trip to Taiwan with my mother and produced a radio documentary about our relationship. It's called Mei Mei, A Daughter's Song.
Well, I know our Buddha take me to heaven. I didn't want to come by. She told me, it's not my time yet. If my time come, that's my home.
Mei Mei, A Daughter's Song won the Peabody and was played all over the world. For the 25th anniversary, I've turned this personal radio production into a film. Join me November 21st at 8 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater for the first ever screening of Mei Mei, A Daughter's Song. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the KBU homepage under Community Events.
KBU Community Radio is proud to announce the opening of Convergence, an audio documentary and sonic artwork by our artist-in-residence, Tessie Word. The opening will be Friday, November 14th from 6 to 8:30 p.m. at Civilian Studios, 2210 North Lewis Avenue in Portland. Convergence examines the historical, environmental, and sociological ramifications of living in an imminent ecological disaster area, the tsunami zones of the Oregon coast near the mouth of the Columbia River. Through the use of phonographic recordings, radio transmissions, and original music, Convergence explores and interprets the cultural implications and the psychic terrain of daily life in the tsunami zone. Again, that's Convergence by KBU Artist-in-Residence Tessie Word, opening Friday, November 14th from 6 to 8:30 p.m. at Civilian Studios, 2210 North Lewis Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to The Digital Divide. I'm your host, Rabia Yeaman. Today on The Digital Divide, we have Robert Fortner speaking with Retraction Watch co-founder Ivan Oransky. Suzanne Legrand will present the last of a five-point series on the Portland technology boom, and we'll listen to an interview I conducted recently with Tom Schroeder, author of the controversial book Acid Test, LSD, Ecstasy, and the Power to Heal. First up, Suzanne Legrand in the final episode of her technology series. Today she explores the continuing tech boom in Portland and how we can use technology where we live and work to help solve problems and help people thrive. Let's listen.
Imagine if you can Portland without Powell's Bookstore. According to technology journalist Kara Swisher, we are rapidly moving to what she calls an instant gratification economy.
Everything is going to be push a button and get. You will not be going outward to get things.
One of the companies pioneering mobile marketing is Urban Airship. They are developing push notification marketing. I talked to Melinda Connett and asked her to explain how push notification marketing works.
Say one of our clients uses our product, and they own a chain of clothing stores. And let's say they're having a sale on shoes. They want to be able to communicate with anybody that comes within a half mile radius. You know, there's a sale going on at the store a quarter of a mile away on shoes. Anybody that gets within that sort of geofence pings the iBeacon, and the iBeacon sends them a notification saying, hey, heads up, you know, you might want to check it out.
Given how rapidly technology is changing, it's hard sometimes to assess whether the change is for the better or for the worse. Here's tech journalist Kara Swisher talking about the next age in computing.
There's all these sort of dystopian ideas about what technology does. So we have to think about what kind of legislation we want to have around it, especially with the controversies around privacy and also spying.
Senator Ron Wyden also spoke at TechFest Northwest on privacy in the digital world. He reminded audiences that in the past, quote, it simply wasn't possible for governments to secretly collect huge amounts of personal information about every single citizen, end quote. Now, however, modern technology makes it easy for governments as well as private corporations to amass a great deal of personal information about law-abiding citizens. As a result, he argued, we need new laws that uphold our right to privacy in the digital age. And, he argued, we also need more government transparency.
The intelligence leadership does a tremendous disservice when they tell the American people something that just isn't true. Look at what Keith Alexander said in Washington, D.C. on YouTube. I mean, he said the government doesn't hold data on Americans, and that's one of the most false statements ever made about U.S. intelligence.
So people want transparency.
I think when we mobilize for it, which is what we showed in the PIPA and SOPA fight, we can win.
TechFest Northwest was one place to begin to have discussions about the positive as well as the negative implications of technology. Liz Kasten, organizer of this year's TechFest Northwest, comments,
some of our topics, if you really look at it, they're subversive. It's not just tech rah-rah-rah. It's talking about difficult issues in tech, drones, the downsides and the benefits to them, talking about how tech is changing Portland, both in good and bad ways, and how we can work together to prevent and curtail some of the harder things, such as rising rents and, you know, keeping our city diverse and sustainable for everybody.
It is in the area of housing that Portlanders are directly experiencing the impact of the new tech boom in Portland. In an article published in Portland Business Magazine, Ali Pera reports that robust growth in the high-tech industry is the reason for strong rent increases in Portland over the past 2 years. Citing research from a report from real estate firm Sebree, the rising rents in Portland can be attributed to, quote, thriving local startups as well as significant inbound expansion from Bay Area and New York tech brands who find Portland's economics, talent, and quality of life irresistible, end quote. In New York City or San Francisco, the average rent for a one-bedroom apartment is over $3,000 a month. In Portland, it's $1,300. To a software developer whose average salary is $81,000 a year, Portland rents look very reasonable. But what about people who don't work in the tech industry? What about nearly half of Portland residents who work at jobs that earn $15 or less an hour? $15 an hour translates to an annual salary of $30,000 before taxes. At this salary, paying an average rent for a one-bedroom in Portland would mean paying over half of your income a year in rent alone. For many Portlanders in this situation, finding affordable housing means that people have to go further and further away from the center of the city. One person who attended a community forum sponsored by Portland's Housing Bureau lamented the fact that she would love to live in a neighborhood that would be close enough for her to be able to bike to work. However, she can't afford to live anywhere near the center of Portland, and living further away means adding commute time as well as transportation costs. At the same community forum, Bishop Stephen Holt showed maps that graphically document the disappearance of African Americans in North and Northeast Portland. In just the last 2 decades, the African American population in these neighborhoods went from 31% to just over 6%. Like San Francisco and New York City, gentrification, fueled by the tech boom, is rapidly changing Portland. New York City, unlike San Francisco, has rent stabilization, which allows people with differing incomes to live within the city. This has helped preserve some of the ethnic and cultural diversity the city is known for. Oregon, however, is the only state besides Texas where rent control is prohibited by state law. It's up to the landlords to set rental prices according to what the market will bear. It's clear that the tech industry in Portland is booming, but the question remains, who will benefit? For those interested in using technology to create a positive social impact in the world, one might ask how technology may be used to solve local problems, such as the housing crisis and gentrification. How can we use technology to create diverse and sustainable communities in Portland in which everyone may thrive? I'm Suzanne LeGrand, reporting for KBOO Community Radio.
You're listening to The Digital Divide on KBOO Portland. Up next, Robert Fortner interviews Retraction Watch co-founder Ivan Aransky.
Thank you, Rabia. I'm speaking with Ivan Aransky, co-founder of Retraction Watch, a blog that tracks the withdrawal of peer-reviewed scientific papers. Ivan has been a senior editor at Scientific American and Reuters Health. He teaches at New York University's Graduate School of Journalism, where he's also an assistant professor of medicine. He is currently editorial director of MedPage Today. Welcome to Digital Divide, Ivan.
Thanks for having me.
So you recently published an article in the New York Times about cracking down on scientific fraudsters. What do you mean by scientific fraud?
That's a good question. Adam Marcus, who's my co-founder at Attraction Watch, he and I published an op-ed in July, and it may help to sort of tell the story of the person we sort of centered on, this guy named Dongpyu Han, who was found to have committed scientific misconduct, scientific fraud, in Iowa. He was at Iowa State University at the time. What he did was actually fake results by spiking rabbit blood. He was working on an HIV vaccine, or a possible HIV vaccine. He spiked that rabbit blood with human blood to make it look as if his HIV vaccine was working in rabbits. And I think that's the kind of thing everyone can very quickly understand is clearly fraud, and obviously it involves science, so this is scientific fraud. And the reason he's facing charges, and the reason why we were writing about this in the New York Times, is that he took federal money to do that. His lab took a total of about $19 million, some millions of which came after these results because they were so promising. And so when you commit fraud, when you do something wrong with federal money, you, we think, should be liable in the same way that you would be if it was, you know, a federal contract of some other kind.
Has this been going on for a long time, and we're just discovering it, or is the scale of misconduct a new development?
Fraud is a very small percentage of what's happening. And while the number of retractions is clearly on the rise, that number grew from